Working remotely, where you are shouldn't dictate what you do. Work from the road by turning your vehicle into a reliable high-speed data Wi-Fi hotspot with AT&T in-car Wi-Fi. On the network that covers more roads than any other carrier, take your work on the road and AT&T will be there to keep you connected. Connect up to 10 devices and stream conference calls, finish up that presentation, or answer last-minute emails. Why wait? Go to att.com/in-car Wi-Fi today for free trial eligibility. Based on independent third-party data, number of devices varies by manufacturer. Always pay careful attention to the road and don't drive distracted. Wi-Fi hotspot intended for passenger use only when vehicle is in operation. Compatible device and vehicle required.
For the ones who work hard to ensure their crew can always go the extra mile, and the ones who get in early so everyone can go home on time, there's Grainger, offering professional-grade supplies backed by product experts so you can quickly and easily find what you need. Plus, you can count on access to a committed team ready to go the extra mile for you. Call, click Grainger.com, or just stop by. Grainger, for the ones who get it done.
It's brand new season two. I'm Marissa Thalberg.
And I'm Stephen Wolf at Adam. And we're excited to be back having bigger, bolder, and always real conversations.
Straight from the C-suite front lines of marketing, media, and more.
We have great friends joining from people you may know, like Vilmer Valderrama and Bobby Burke.
And people you'll want to know. So grab a coffee or, hey, even an Aperol Spritz and come join us on America's number one podcast network, iHeart.
Listen to brand new on the iHeart Radio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Something that makes me crazy is when people say, well, I had this career before, but it was a waste. And that's where the perspective shift comes, that it's not a waste, that everything you've done has built you to where you are now. This is She Pivots, the podcast where we explore the inspiring pivots women have made and dig deeper into the personal reasons behind them. Join me, Emily Tisch Sussman, every Wednesday on She Pivots. Listen to She Pivots on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Welcome to Tech Stuff, a production from iHeartRadio. Hey there, and welcome to Tech Stuff. I'm your host, Jonathan Strickland. I'm an executive producer with iHeartRadio, and I love all things tech. And it is time, once again, my friends, for a classic episode. And this one published on October 9th, 2013. It is titled, Pacemakers Got the Beat. This just reminds me of how much work I put into making really, really cringy titles back in the day. I still do it occasionally, but man, I was really on a roll in 2013. Let's listen in to this classic episode.
What do you mean electrical impulses?
That's how the heart works.
That's crazy.
We have natural pacemakers, and sometimes they work less well than others. But so pacemakers are small devices that are implanted nearish the heart in the general chest area.
Chest cavity, shoulder, abdomen, somewhere around there.
Mm-hmm. They use low energy electrical impulses to help control any abnormal heart rhythms, sometimes called
arrhythmias.
Arrhythmias.
Yeah,
thank you.
I had an arrhythmia as a child.
Oh, did you?
Yep. I had an arrhythmia and a heart murmur.
Wow, that's exciting.
Yeah.
In the bad way.
Anyway, yes, arrhythmias.
So those can be that your heart is beating either too fast, too slow, or irregularly. And there are more long words for all of those things. Which
right.
I'm
not... Yeah, there's a tachycardia.
There
and,
you go, yeah.
And bradycardia.
Yes.
So those are the two. So bradycardia is if it's beating too slowly,
mm-hmm.
and tachycardia is when it's too quickly.
Sure. There's also other conditions that can wrap up into needing a pacemaker, aka atrial fibrillation, mm-hmm. in which the upper chambers of the heart kind of quiver instead of really contracting.
Yeah. So in order for you to really understand what we're talking about here, the heart is divided up into four chambers, right?
Right. The left and right atria, which are the upper chambers, and the left and right ventricles, which are the lower chambers.
Right. So the upper chambers, the atria, when they contract, they force blood down into the ventricles, which then when they contract, force it throughout the rest of the body.
Right.
And so the combination of these two contractions are what we think of as the heartbeat, the whole lub-dub thing.
Lub-dub is that.
Yeah, so that's the lub, the atria, and the dub, the ventricles. So, there's just plenty of room for romance.
But so if one of these is not working out correctly, then it screws up the entire process.
It's a huge problem, right? So if the atria are doing this fibrillation where they are quivering instead of beating, then it's not providing the right amount of blood to the ventricles to pump it through the rest of the body. That's obviously an issue.
Mm-hmm.
But there's another one too, right?
There's also heart block in which the electrical signal is slowed or disrupted as it moves through the heart.
So again, a problem with actually the signal reaching the place where it needs to go so that you have a healthy heartbeat.
Right. It's like if the cover on your wire is a little bit screwy.
And, oh, gotcha.
You know, something to that extent. Except the wire is your heart, and you need that wire pretty badly.
Yeah, and it's unless you're the Tin Man, you pretty much need one.
And these conditions can be caused by all kinds of disease and other wackiness.
It could be an inherited condition.
Mm-hmm.
It can be
after a heart attack, if a heart attack damages the muscle.
Right. Yeah. There are injuries that can end up injuring the heart as a result. Yeah. So there's lots of different ways that this could happen, including things like just coming out of a surgery that's unrelated to your heart. That can happen
too. Sure. Absolutely. Okay. So what happens when your heart lacks rhythm?
You can no longer do really crazy dances like the electric slide.
Okay, true enough. However, it mostly means that your body might not be getting enough blood, which would cause tiredness, lightheadedness, breathlessness, even like fainting, organ damage, and can potentially even lead to death if it goes unchecked. Unchecked.
Yeah. So we're talking about very serious stuff. Now, a healthy adult has a heart rate at rest that's what, between 60 and 100 beats per minute, something like that?
Yep.
So and mine's on the high end, which is actually not great. It means that, honestly, that Jonathan needs to exercise more so that I have a healthier cardio life. And that's something that I am working on because it's a concern, right? I'm getting to a certain age. Physically, if not mentally or emotionally. So I need to prepare for that.
Generally, a slower heartbeat within that range is ideal. And healthy heartbeats are regular because we have, like I said earlier, those built-in pacemakers. Those are the sinoatrial, I said that right, yes, nodes.
Yes,
which sit at the upper right atria.
Okay, gotcha. So this is kind of the signal that lets the atria know to contract. So once that signal goes through to contract the atria, what happens then? Like, how does it then move on to the ventricle system?
It passes through another node, the atrioventricular node.
Oh, wow. Yeah. Okay, cool. So you got two nodes that are doing this, and they're doing it in a very precise rhythm so that it creates this contraction that then pumps the blood through the rest of the body.
Oh, right. And if that sinoatrial node isn't working properly, the atrioventricular node can take over for it, but it's a weaker force.
So it's not as efficient.
It's only going to get you up to about 40 beats per minute, which is why you're going to encounter that fatigue and breathlessness and stuff like that.
Right. So you'll live, but you'll be getting
but
an
poorly.
Increasingly poor condition.
Sure.
Right. So what do pacemakers do?
Pacemakers can regulate that. They can help slow the rhythm of a too fast heartbeat or help control an irregular or too fast rhythm.
Oh, okay.
Or too slow rhythm.
Gotcha. So they can monitor the impulses and override it, or pulses, I guess I should say, and override it so that it has a more regular heartbeat and keep someone at an optimal heartbeat range, right?
Sure. And and if those two nodes are not communicating properly, a pacemaker can help coordinate the electrical signals between them.
I see. So if maybe the sinoatrial node's working just fine, but perhaps the ventricular one's not, then this could help balance that out.
Right. Sure. And it does this because, so a pacemaker is essentially a very small generator hooked up to a battery in a computer.
Okay.
Again, very small battery and very small computer.
Yeah, you have to be if
implantable.
You want to have an implant. Yeah.
Sure. And wires are threaded from the pacemaker through a vein to the heart. Those wires being tipped with electrodes.
Mm-hmm.
And the electrodes detect your heart's electrical activity and rhythm and then send that information to the computer, which will monitor them.
Mm-hmm.
It will direct the generator to fire whenever the signals go wonky.
All right. So what the computer is doing is looking for any irregularities and
sure.
then it addresses that.
Right.
Okay.
Right. It can also record these signals for your doctor to upload and use to adjust your pacemaker using a wireless device. They don't have to do surgery on you in order to check it because they want to check it about quarterly. So that would be messy.
So this is kind of like a a very important version of a physical activity tracker. It's keeping data on the activity of your heart and letting your doctor know exactly what's going on.
Right, right. In some cases, that onboard computer can even be accessed remotely via the interwebs.
Oh, so for those of you who are privacy worried about that kind of thing, the idea that your heart rate is being monitored remotely.
Maybe not for you.
I actually think it's super awesome. Like the idea that a doctor would have that level of granular information about a patient's health and even be able to preemptively tell the patient, hey, I'm detecting some unusual readings here. Could you come in so that we can make sure that you are in good shape?
That it's not an equipment malfunction.
Right.
And, you know,
obviously that would be incredibly important. And if it were
you know, I mean, there's some people have pacemakers who are basically doing okay. It's more precautionary.
Sure.
But there are other very life-threatening ventricular diseases.
Sure,
that, you know.
Sure.
Yeah, some models called rate responsive models will actually adjust to your heart rate, to your changes in activity.
Gotcha. Like, which again, makes sense for example, like if you're exerting yourself, then you might need a different heart rate than if you were at rest. And that's why I remember older pacemakers, that was a real challenge because they would keep a very steady heart rate, which was great.
But if you break into a brisk jog, then
your heart wouldn't be able to keep up.
And the computer would start misfiring.
Right. So that was a real issue.
Sure, sure. So there are three basic types of pacemakers. You've got single chamber, which carry impulses from the generator to the heart's right ventricle.
Mm-hmm.
Dual chamber, which carry those impulses to the right ventricle and the right atrium.
Mm-hmm.
And also help coordinate the timing between the two. And then you've got biventricular, which carry those impulses to the right atrium and both ventricles.
Gotcha.
Helping coordinate all of the signals. And those are, for as you can imagine, those are increasing in seriousness.
Right, right. Obviously, because you're talking about having to take over more and more of the heart's activity.
Mm-hmm. There are also related implantable cardioverter. Did I say that right?
Yep.
Yes. Implantable cardioverter defibrillators,
right. Which
use not only those low energy impulses that a regular pacemaker would use, but also high energy impulses when necessary to treat very life-threatening
arrhythmias.
Issues.
Yeah, yeah.
Right.
So, like, if you're, for example, there, I'll talk about some of the early ones of this, but there are some devices that, let's say, that it detects that your heart, maybe you're going into cardiac arrest, it can actually deliver a strong enough electrical impulse to possibly, you know, kickstart your heart going again.
Right.
So it ends up being like, you know, if you guys have ever seen any medical procedural, you have obviously seen the person with the pads.
Right.
Yeah.
Which like, they clear, usually use incorrectly, but
yeah,
that's okay.
Yeah. The clear part's important, by the way.
Yes.
But, now he's doing poorly from too much electric. This is something that's sort of an implantable device that does a similar thing, although it does it in a very precise way because it's delivering it directly to the heart. And not every pacemaker does this.
Right.
There's specific
types
of devices.
Yeah. They can also, like Jonathan said earlier, be temporary if you've just had a heart attack or a surgery or perhaps overdosed, while the patient is in the hospital with these kinds of issues, they might have a temporary pacemaker.
Yeah.
And of course the permanent ones, which is more what we've been talking about. I mean, they wouldn't implant a temporary one.
Right. Yeah. In fact, the earliest pacemakers are more like what you would see with a temporary pacemaker. I mean, the temporary ones that we use now are far more sophisticated.
Oh, of course.
Orders of magnitude more sophisticated. But the idea is that you would have an external device that would be able, you know, anyone could monitor and also be able to, like a medical professional would be able to disconnect it once that was a viable option and wires would go into you. Which is kind of, you know, depending upon your level of comfort, a little squeaky. But
I'm honestly pretty squeaked out by the entire wire through a vein thing. That's,
yeah. Well, just wait till we talk about the history of pacemakers,
because
that's going to get really interesting.
I'm glad you took that research.
Yeah.
So in the case of permanent pacemakers, batteries and generators usually have to be replaced every 5 to 15 years, usually about 6 or 7. It's really the batteries start running down and they figure while we're performing surgery on you, we might as well change out the generator to make sure that it doesn't start running down too.
Right, right. So that way it actually decreases the number of surgeries you would need over your lifetime.
Right, sure. Yeah, the lifetime of the product,
lifetime
aka
of you.
Your lifetime.
Yeah.
And the wires may eventually need to be replaced as well, but that's more case-to-case basis kind
right.
of thing.
Now, we talked about in our electronics and FAA episode about electromagnetic interference and even discussed a little bit about how people with pacemakers need to be careful around devices that emit EMI, which is pretty much anything that's electrical.
Oh, right, right. And that's because like any electrical signal, the impulses sent by a pacemaker can be disrupted by an electromagnetic field.
Yeah. So now granted, in most cases, the instructions you get are pretty...
It's pretty common sense.
Yeah, I mean, it's stuff like don't lay down and put a laptop computer or a cell phone or
over your heart.
Yeah, you don't want to have like your cell phone in your shirt pocket, for example.
Right, right. You know, avoid brushing up next to strong household appliances, industrial
right.
welders.
Don't lay directly against the microwave as you wait for that sweet, sweet popcorn to be delivered to your hands.
You know, keep your generators, your larger than your heart generator at arm's length.
Right.
Don't
right.
use jackhammers.
Yeah.
That kind of thing.
I never do. And everyone thanks me. Yeah. So
I mean, things like metal detectors are fine if they're, you know, you're supposed to tell security agents like, hey, I've got this pacemaker thing. Please
right.
don't kill me.
Right. Right.
And they will know how to deal with that.
Yeah. So it's certainly one of those things that does mean, you know, you have to take that into account in your lifestyle. Sure. But it's also a development that has, like we said, given a huge number of people a chance at a healthy life that otherwise they would not have.
Hey guys, it's Jonathan from 2020. We are going to take a break on this episode about pacemakers to thank our sponsors, but we'll be right back.
Working remotely, where you are shouldn't dictate what you do. Work from the road by turning your vehicle into a reliable high-speed data Wi-Fi hotspot with AT&T in-car Wi-Fi. On the network that covers more roads than any other carrier, take your work on the road and AT&T will be there to keep you connected. Connect up to 10 devices and stream conference calls, finish up that presentation, or answer last-minute emails. Why wait? Go to att.com/in-car Wi-Fi today for free trial eligibility. Based on independent third-party data, number of devices varies by manufacturer. Always pay careful attention to the road and don't drive distracted. Wi-Fi hotspot intended for passenger use only when vehicle is in operation. Compatible device and vehicle required.
Without the ones like you, who work tirelessly to keep things running, everything would suddenly stop. Hospitals, factories, schools, and power plants, they all depend on you. No matter the weather, emergency, or time of day, you're the ones who get it done. At Grainger, we're here for you, with professional-grade industrial supplies. Count on real-time product availability and fast delivery. Call, clickgrainger.com or just stop by. Grainger, for the ones who get it done.
Something that makes me crazy is when people say, well, I had this career before, but it was a waste. And that's where the perspective shift comes, that it's not a waste, that everything you've done has built you to where you are now. This is She Pivots, the podcast where we explore the inspiring pivots women have made and dig deeper into the personal reasons behind them. Join me, Emily Tisch Sussman, every Wednesday on She Pivots as I sit down with inspiring women like Misty Copeland, Brooke Shields, Vanessa Hudgens, and so many more. We dive into how these women made their pivot and their mindset shifts that happened as a result. It's a podcast about women, their stories, and how their pivot became their success. Listen to She Pivots on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
The Big Take from Bloomberg News brings you what's shaping the world's economies with the smartest and best-informed business reporters around the world.
Western nations like the U.S. and Europe.
Mexico will likely have its first female president.
And then you have China.
And help you understand what's happening, what it means, and why it matters.
He'll get his yo-yos to Europe in time. But the longer this drags on, the more worry he's getting.
They knew that they needed to do this as fast as they possibly could to get a drug on the market as fast as they could.
I'm David Gura.
I'm Sarah Holder.
I'm Saleha Mohsen. We cover the stories behind what's moving money and markets.
basically everyone was expecting, if not a calamity, certainly a recession.
But the problem is that that paperwork, as our reporting showed, is fake.
As someone who's covering the market, I'm often very worried about an imminent collapse. So I'm thinking about it quite often.
Listen to The Big Take on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Now let's get back to talking about pacemakers. Now, in this particular episode, we kind of divided up the research a bit. So Lauren ended up looking a lot at how the heart works and how pacemakers tend to work.
If you guys have ever listened to Forward Thinking, you know that I am the medical correspondent.
Yeah, so, yes. We make her look at all the squicky stuff so we don't have to, because she likes squicky stuff, like slime.
Slime is really great, guys.
Yeah.
Although I would argue, glancing through your notes here for the history, that you actually got the short end of the squick stick.
You know what?
I want to never use the phrase squick stick again.
This is entering into a realm that I actually relish. Because we're talking about a realm of scientific exploration that definitely goes on that mad scientist side of the scale. I mean,
in that really cool kind of Victorian era.
Yeah, this is the same era where we saw things like Mary Shelley's Frankenstein be published. And so that's, you know, and some of the stuff that was being talked about and discovered at this time plays into the narrative of that story, although in a, you know, much more kind of literary way and not a scientific way.
Sure.
But at any rate, this is when we had people really thinking about electricity and its effect on the human body, and not just the human body, as it turns out. So you really, to talk about the history of the pacemaker, have to go all the way back to the mid-1700s. That's
wow.
That's when people started to experiment with what they called electrostimulation, using electricity to stimulate muscles. And in fact, by this time, they were looking at cardiac electrostimulation. So again, using electricity to stimulate the heart.
This was all in animals at the time.
Yeah. So they would find recently dead animals, or they would make an animal recently dead. And then they would use some form of electricity to use an electricity source to stimulate the animal's heart. The electricity sources?
Yeah, at the time they had Leyden jars and
voltaic piles.
Right.
Or peels, actually, you should say voltaic peels.
Oh,
it's actually
that.
It's because it's French.
After a person? Oh, okay.
Yeah, so peel is French, but it's voltaic peels or piles if you prefer.
Both of which are batteries. They are viable batteries, but very dangerous.
Yeah, and not particularly strong unless you make huge stacks,
right?
So these are predecessors to what we consider the modern battery. But that was when there was a lot of experimentation going on. So they would use them to stimulate the cardiac nerves in animals in an attempt to resuscitate intact dead animals. And thus, as my notes say, infect the world with chipmunk zombies.
Oh, no.
So there was a fellow named Luigi Galvani who was credited with proposing electricity as the mechanism that causes our muscles to operate. Now, here's the story. This is very possibly apocryphal, but the story, the legend goes that Galvani was working on dissecting a little froggy.
Okay.
And ended up building up an electrostatic charge, and picked up a scalpel and touched the scalpel to the froggy, and it discharged the electrostatic charge, which created the spark and made the froggy's leg twitch. Thus, Galvani began to think of electricity as being the means through which our muscles operate. He called it animal electricity, as opposed to what was being called heat electricity.
Okay.
So he thought that animal electricity was some sort of electrical type of fluid that would make muscles move. Before then, idea of ballooning.
Leyden jars were still based on the principle that electricity was a fluid.
Yeah.
Isn't that correct?
Yeah, yeah. So this is the early days of learning about electricity. So, at any rate, that research led other people to start to, tinker around. One of those was William Hawes, H-A-W-E-S. He established a society in London called the Humane Society. But it's not the Humane Society the way we would think of it in the United States. You hear the Humane Society and you think, oh, that's an animal rescue, right?
It's not for adopting dogs and cats.
No. This was a group that was dedicated to, salvaging people who appear to be dead.
This was a big concern at the time. A lot of people you know, we didn't really have the more precise scientific definitions, and even today this is debatable, of what is alive and what is dead. And we, you know, we didn't have heart rate monitors.
It was a morbid time, really, is what it was.
It was a lot harder to tell. And so there was a huge fear of getting buried alive.
Yeah. So there was also a similar society at the time in Paris. I assume Paris, France, not Paris, Texas. Eventually, the organization would become the Royal Humane Society of London. And very early on during the society's days, scientists began to explore electrostimulation as a way of resuscitating people who appear to have died and maybe who are not actually dead but could be revived. So 1788, a guy named Charles Kite writes a paper titled An Essay Upon the Recovery of the Apparently Dead, which is already my favorite title of a paper since Moore wrote Cramming More Components on Integrated Circuits. I love these titles. This is the best kind of research, really. So according to the essay, Kite used electrostimulation to treat a 3-year-old child. She had fallen out of a window and appeared to be dead. They had called in an apothecary who was unable to do anything. Kite said that it was 20 minutes before he could arrive to provide some sort of electrostimulation to the child's heart. He used essentially electrodes to deliver a gentle electrical shock to various parts of the child's body, eventually settling on the thorax or chest, really, and found that he got a pulse when he did that, and claimed that the child woke up, was very groggy and confused about her surroundings, but that she eventually made a full recovery. What that tells me is that this story is probably either exaggerated or there are some big missing components, because being dead for 20 minutes is being dead.
Is dead.
Yeah, you're not bouncing back from that, really.
No.
But at any rate,
it could be that no one at the house at the time could find a heartbeat.
Right. Could have been that she had a very weak pulse.
Sure.
Intermittent pulse, even. So at any rate, that's the story from 1788. In 1796, a couple of Danish scientists published a paper that was titled Life-Saving Measures for Drowning Persons and Information of the Best Means by Which They Can Be Brought Back to Life. And that also included electrostimulation of the heart as a means of saving people. We're going to jump ahead. So there's a lot of people researching this. In 1820, Dr. De Sanctis in The Medical Guide described the reanimation chair. I didn't show you a picture of this yet, have I, Lauren?
You did not, but I'm already concerned.
You're going to get a chance to see it.
We'll link it on social as well.
The chair included bellows, which were meant to force air into the person's lungs, a metallic tube inserted into the person's esophagus, and a voltaic peel or pile, depending upon how you want to pronounce it, attached at one end of the metal tube, and the other end was to an electrode. The electrode was then touched to, quote, regions of the heart, the diaphragm, and the stomach, end quote, to cause muscles to contract. If you look at this thing, or illustrations of this thing, I should say, I haven't seen a picture of one. I don't know if one was ever actually built, but the illustrations of what it was supposed to look like it came from Hostel or Saw or one of those movies. It is absolutely terrifying to behold. It makes a dentist chair look absolutely comforting by comparison.
It's Jonathan from 2020 again. We're going to take another quick break from this classic episode, but we will return shortly.
Working remotely, where you are shouldn't dictate what you do. Work from the road by turning your vehicle into a reliable high-speed data Wi-Fi hotspot with AT&T in-car Wi-Fi. On the network that covers more roads than any other carrier, take your work on the road and AT&T will be there to keep you connected. Connect up to 10 devices and stream conference calls, finish up that presentation, or answer last-minute emails. Why wait? Go to att.com/in-car Wi-Fi today for free trial eligibility. Based on independent third-party data, number of devices varies by manufacturer. Always pay careful attention to the road and don't drive distracted. Wi-Fi hotspot intended for passenger use only when vehicle is in operation. Compatible device and vehicle required.
For the ones who work hard to ensure their crew can always go the extra mile, and the ones who get in early so everyone can go home on time, there's Grainger, offering professional-grade supplies backed by product experts so you can quickly and easily find what you need. Plus, you can count on access to a committed team ready to go the extra mile for you. Call, clickgrainger.com, or just stop by. Grainger. For the ones who get it done.
Something that makes me crazy is when people say, well, I had this career before, but it was a waste. And that's where the perspective shift comes, that it's not a waste, that everything you've done has built you to where you are now. This is She Pivots, the podcast where we explore the inspiring pivots women have made and dig deeper into the personal reasons behind them. Join me, Emily Tisch Sussman, every Wednesday on She Pivots as I sit down with inspiring women like Misty Copeland, Brooke Shields, Vanessa Hudgens, and so many more. We dive into how these women made their pivot and their mindset shifts that happened as a result. It's a podcast about women, their stories, and how their pivot became their success. Listen to She Pivots on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
The Big Take from Bloomberg News brings you what's shaping the world's economies with the smartest and best-informed business reporters around the world.
Western nations like the U.S. and Europe.
Mexico will likely have its first female president.
And then you have China.
And help you understand what's happening, what it means, and why it matters.
He'll get his yo-yos to Europe in time. But the longer this drags on, the more worry he's getting.
They knew that they needed to do this as fast as they possibly could to get a drug on the market as fast as they could.
I'm David Gura.
I'm Sarah Holder.
I'm Saleha Mohsen. We cover the stories behind what's moving money and markets.
Basically, everyone was expecting, if not a calamity, certainly a recession.
But the problem is that that paperwork, as our reporting showed, is fake.
As someone who's covering the market, I'm often very worried about an imminent collapse. So I'm thinking about it quite often.
Listen to The Big Take on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Experiments with electropuncture. This is where we're really getting into the fun stuff.
So that is combining electrical stimulation with acupuncture?
Yep. So you got a needle that you insert into the body of your subject, and then you shoot electricity through it to
subject.
Stimulate.
Patient.
Yeah. Well,
hopefully.
Animal. Probably.
Okay.
It was mostly animals.
Sure.
Mostly dogs, actually. I didn't want to dwell on that too much because I love my doggies.
Yeah.
So anyway, it turned out, the early experiments anyway, turned out to be, I'll use the word failure. So no Franken doggies from this particular early experimentation. However, other people would start to experiment with using insulated needles that could deliver an electrical shock
To a specific
point, mm-hmm. The point of the needle, in fact. And that would, in fact, be the basis for early pacemakers.
Huh.
They did discover that by refining this process, that they could stimulate activity in a heart that was undergoing cardiac arrest. And again, they were using animals. And essentially, in order to experiment, they would over-anesthetize animals in order to induce cardiac arrest.
Mm-hmm.
So we would see more and more experiments between 1828 and 1930, which is the next date I have on my list. I don't want to be too exhaustive with this. And also, they get pretty weird. And when you start talking about getting cadavers from recent executions, it starts to get pretty grim. So I'm going to skip over that. We skip over the entire Victorian era. We skip over Jack the Ripper. Listen to stuff you missed in history class. They cover all that kind of stuff. All right. So 1930, that's when a fellow by the name of Albert S. Hyman develops and patents the artificial pacemaker.
Wow, in 1930.
Yeah, so this thing did not look like a pacemaker as you and I would recognize if we were to see one.
Which are large coin sized these days.
Yeah, they're in the grand scheme of medical devices, they are tiny.
Mm-hmm.
This one was not tiny. This was a hand crank.
Whew.
Okay, so you had a hand crank and it had wires, cables essentially, that ended in needles that could be inserted into a person. And by turning the hand crank, there was also a spring motor inside of it that turned a magneto, which is a DC current generator. So essentially what you're doing is you're turning, we've talked about inducing electricity to flow by using moving a conductor through a fluctuating magnetic field.
Mm-hmm.
This is a way of doing that by hand. You turn the crank,
turning it
through this magnetic field, and that's mm-hmm. inducing electricity to flow. And that ends up supplying the electricity needed for the pacemaker. The insulated needle would deliver the electric charge to the right atrium of the heart. And by March 1st, 1932, the pacemaker had been used 43 times with a successful outcome in 14 cases, which is about a 33% success rate, which sounds incredibly low, but then keep in mind that the essentially
this was an absolute last.
This was last ditch effort to try and revive someone. So it wasn't like this. These were not the type of pacemakers we've talked about in our episode where we talked about the things that you would have in your chest for a prolonged period. This was really meant to revive someone.
Yeah, sure.
So this is a little different. They call it a pacemaker.
So 33% of patients saved is actually
Better than 0%.
Pretty rad.
And so 1940s, that's when they started to engineers and doctors began to work on designing defibrillators, which, as we said, can play a part in some types of pacemakers that you can find today that are, it's kind of a combination device, really.
Sure.
1959, an elderly man who in the literature is called HN, they don't obviously identify people
because it's medical,
but HN suffered heart ailments for several years, had heart attacks and other irregularities, and became the recipient of a Tronic Products 902M battery-operated pacemaker. Now, this was not an internal unit. It was not an implant in that sense. They did implant the electrodes so that they had contact with the heart, but the cables to the actual device were external,
mm-hmm.
and you would have to carry the pacemaker around with you,
mm-hmm.
and it was held outside the body. You know, it could also detect spontaneous cardiac activity. It had a meter.
Attached?
Yeah, it essentially had the ability to tell if something was going wrong. Well, it wasn't necessarily able to respond to that dynamically, but it could at least warn a caregiver that something was happening. Everything it worked all right. The one problem was that the area where the electrodes would go in through the skin, essentially the needle would go in through the skin, was prone to minor infections. There was never
That's what you would expect from. I mean, and that's part of the reason why the drive to create implantable pacemakers exists.
Right. And we talked about, the fact that in our piercing episode or our body modification episode, we talked about that there is a possibility of developing these kind of infections, and they may not be serious. It may not mm-hmm. be life threatening, but they can be problematic. And that was exactly what he had experienced. It wasn't an infection that was developing into sepsis, but it was like he would have to have the area cleaned regularly so that he could clear out any infection. In late 1962, he underwent surgery for a pacemaker implant, but he never fully recovered. In fact, he never recovered from the surgical procedure. He died 20 days after the surgical procedure. So that was an unfortunate tragedy there. But he did have lived for several years with this external pacemaker. In 1960, Dr. Robert Rubio implanted a pacemaker into a female patient, and that pacemaker was 52.5 millimeters in diameter, which is about 2 inches, 17.5 millimeters thick, which is about 0.7 inches, so just over half an inch, and weighed 64.3 grams or 2.3 ounces or less than a quarter of a pound. Now, that one got power from two rechargeable nickel-cadmium batteries, which were charged through induction from an external flexible coil placed on the skin over the pacemaker. So this is the way some pacemakers are recharged today, using a similar approach, although it's usually radio frequencies. But what we're talking about wireless power here, right? Where you can induce this charging through, it's all about magnetic fields and electricity. That's really what we get down to. So you would have to place this flexible coil directly over your heart in order to recharge the pacemaker. Or really directly over the pacemaker, wherever the pacemaker was located, wherever the battery was. The stimulated electrode for this was a platinum disc, so it was an expensive piece of medical technology. But sadly, the patient died 9.5 months after the surgery because she did develop an infection which turned into sepsis after the surgery. So the pacemaker was working, but it was a side effect of the surgery. She unfortunately perished from that. So early implantable pacemakers varied widely in how long they could operate before requiring a recharge. So one of them would only go like 8 hours and then you'd have to recharge it. That's pretty rough.
Yeah.
But there were others that could go weeks or even months before a recharge, even in the early days in the 60s.
Mm-hmm. This also, still today, how much your pacemaker is actually needing to create a charge will make your battery life vary.
Right. So in other words, if it's only occasionally having to intervene, then you're recharging. You may not need to recharge it as frequently as someone where it's more active more Absolutely. Frequently. So in the 1960s, that's when we started to see the cardiac stimulator defibrillators, which we kind of talked about. It's called something else today, but same sort of idea. The device that can detect when a heartbeat stops and then try to restart it with a controlled electrical burst to the heart. The early versions of that were also not implantable. They were external as well, but now we've got implantable ones that are incorporated with sort of pacemaker technology. Now, as far as the future goes, because from the 1960s on to the present, it was really refining that process.
Mm-hmm. It's just about a miniaturization yep. And exactly, improvements in electrical stimulation.
Yep. Yep. Making sure that we were getting more precise and smaller. Those are really the trends. So anything from 1960s on is more about refining that design. Talking about the future, miniaturization is going to continue to be a factor. In fact, there are companies right now that are trying to create pacemakers that are about the size of a pill.
Oh, wow.
So that tiny. So the reason why you want this is not just because it takes up less space in the patient. Really, it's because the surgical procedures become less invasive. It's less damage to the body, less chance for infection, makes it less chance for something to go wrong, because mm-hmm. it's just a smaller surgical procedure. So that's really where we're seeing the future come in as far as pacemakers are concerned.
And that wraps up this classic episode of Tech Stuff. Hope you guys enjoyed it. If you have any suggestions for future topics that we should cover on the show, reach out on Twitter or Facebook. The handle at both of those is TechStuffHSW, and I'll talk to you again really soon. Tech Stuff is an iHeartRadio production. For more podcasts from iHeartRadio, visit the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you listen to your favorite shows.
Without the ones like you, who work tirelessly to keep things running, everything would suddenly stop. Hospitals, factories, schools, and power plants, they all depend on you. No matter the weather, emergency, or time of day, you're the ones who get it done. At Grainger, we're here for you, with professional-grade industrial supplies. Count on real-time product availability and fast delivery. Call, clickgrainger.com, or just stop by. Grainger, for the ones who get it done.
It's brand new season two. I'm Marissa Thalberg.
And I'm Stephen Wolf Bedatum. And we're excited to be back having bigger, bolder, and always real conversations.
Straight from the C-suite front lines of marketing, media, and more.
We have great friends joining from people you may know, like Wilmer Valderrama and Bobby Burke.
And people you'll want to know. So grab a coffee or, hey, even an Aperol Spritz and come join us on America's number one podcast network, iHeart.
Listen to brand new on the iHeart Radio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Something that makes me crazy is when people say, well, I had this career before, but it was a waste. And that's where the perspective shift comes, that it's not a waste, that everything you've done has built you to where you are now. This is She Pivots, the podcast where we explore the inspiring pivots women have made and dig deeper into the personal reasons behind them. Join me, Emily Tisch Sussman, every Wednesday on She Pivots. Listen to She Pivots on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
I'm Saleha Mohsen, and I've covered economic policy for years and reported on how it impacts people across the United States. In 2016, I saw how voters were leaning towards Trump and how so many Americans felt misunderstood by Washington. So I started The Big Take DC. We dig into how money, politics, and power shape government and the consequences for voters. With new episodes every Thursday, you can listen to The Big Take DC on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.